I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. It turns out Freddie Gray was just one among thousands of arrested suspects turned away from Baltimore City jails upon arrival due to physical injuries. In Sunday's Baltimore Sun, investigative reporter Mark Puente wrote that over the past 3 years, thousands of arrested suspects showed up with a variety of problems from hypertension to broken bones. We'll hear from attorney Dwight Pettit about what he calls the callous indifference of police toward the public, and from criminologist Jeffrey Ian Ross on common police practices. Plus, we'll speak to Fern Shen of Baltimore Brew about Marilyn Mosby's father, a former police officer who was kicked off his Boston police force in 1989. That's Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast of Maryland Morning, filling in for Dan Rodericks. We're coming to you from WYPR in Baltimore, WYPF in Frederick, WYPO in Ocean City and the Eastern Shore, and streaming online at WYPR.org. An article published this past weekend in the Baltimore Sun highlighted how many Baltimore police officers have failed to provide adequate medical care to those they arrest. The story, co-written by reporters Mark Puente and Meredith Cohn, cites records that show that between June 2012 and April 2015, close to 2,600 detainees in police custody at the Baltimore City Detention Center were not admitted by correctional officers. That was because central booking intake officers recorded the detainees had injuries that included fractured bones, facial trauma, and hypertension, the article said. Since the death of Freddie Gray, Baltimore's police department has yet to formally announce any actions taken to address the problem, even though the city has paid close to $6 million since 2011, compensating people who sustained but were not adequately treated for injuries in police custody. The Federal Justice Department has announced they will investigate the city's police force for claims of excessive force. If you would like to join our conversation, give us a call at 410-662-8780 or toll free at 866-661-9309. Or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. With me here in the studio is A. Dwight Pettit, a defense lawyer who's represented several clients in abuse lawsuits against city police officers. He represented the family of Tyrone West, who died while in police custody in July 2013 from what the autopsy report called positional asphyxiation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sheila.
And joining Midday by phone from Washington, D.C. is University of Baltimore criminologist and professor Jeffrey Ian Ross. He's also the author of several books, including An Introduction to Political Crime and Making News of Police Violence. Thanks for joining us, Jeffrey.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great.
Dwight Pettit, let me mention you also have written a book on this topic that you published in 2013, Under Color of Law. You've seen the history of police brutality in Baltimore City. What is your reaction to the news of these 2,600 injured suspects?
Well, that doesn't surprise me at all. And when I commented for the Sun's article, I indicated that most of the cases that I would be aware of would be cases where those injuries were, in fact, inflicted by the police. And so that's why I would believe they would be very callous to seeking medical attention for the victims, because they, in fact, inflicted the injuries themselves. So the number still shocks me, that type of figure is relevant and prevalent to what's happening in terms of police arrests and what have you. But since that I've been doing this since for 42 years, since 1973, it's not shocking, because my practice has basically been overwhelmed by police brutality cases, although a major part of my practice appears to also be wrongful death, which would not include those people
who were
injured. But most of the clients...
The Sun calculated that the number of detainees turned away is about 2% of all those arrested. So as a sort of a measure of the problem, you think it is that much?
Yes, it doesn't surprise me at all.
Jeffrey Ian Ross, reports about excessive police force in Baltimore are not new. Why hasn't the issue been addressed, in your view?
Well, there's a numerous reasons. I think in every big city police department, you're going to get police use of excessive force, alleged use of police use of excessive force, and periodically you're going to have officers who are identified either by people who are victimized or by the news media, by lawyers who have a client who claims that there has been some sort of use of excessive force. And so this sort of thing doesn't surprise me. The issue that I find more interesting is why haven't we done something to reduce the numbers of these incidents, the incidents that are substantiated. And there's a long history for regarding this in the United States. Back in 1994, Congress passed the crime bill. One of the provisions of the crime bill was that it the Department of Justice was instructed to collect data on police use of excessive force. And this has morphed over the years in terms of the way we collect data on police use of excessive force. And the long and the short of it is that the amount of police use of excessive force during encounters based on this data is very, very low. So there's and it's poses a whole bunch of different questions and challenges for people trying to get a fix on the amount of it. Back to the numbers, that being 2,600 appearing at the Baltimore Detention Center with some sort of injury, that does not surprise me. I would assume that you're going to have similar kinds of statistics in other big cities in the United States. The fact that it's about 2% of all arrested, again, that doesn't surprise me. And there's multiple explanations for those injuries, including police use of excessive force during the pursuit, during the arrest. There may be some cases of self-injury, but it is a disturbing feature of law enforcement in Baltimore and other big cities in the United States.
But Dwight Pettit, let me ask you the same question I asked Professor Ross. Why, in your view, has this not been addressed? Why are these numbers still so high when there has been discussion of police brutality for so long?
Well, I think Baltimore has sort of turned its back and refused to acknowledge what's been happening. And I've seen this increase dramatically in the past 10, 15, 20 years. I think contributing in Baltimore City is not only the omnibus crime bill that Jeffrey was talking about, but also the zero tolerance that was implemented under the O'Malley administration.
When O'Malley was mayor.
Right. And that, to me, led to not only an omnipotence in terms of the police, believing that they did not have to recognize constitutional rights of the citizens, but it also created a confrontational situation between the community and the police, which I think has been allowed to grow and to fester. And so when I saw what happened in Ferguson, when I saw what happened in New York, when I saw what happened in South Carolina, I said to myself, oh, Lord and behold, wait till they discover Baltimore.
Jeff Ross, there are investigations set to be conducted by the U.S. Department of Justice. Do you have any idea what they'll entail? Do you have any idea whether they will shed some light on this particular problem?
If this goes forward, I'm assuming what they're going to see, what they're going to look for primarily is whether or not Mr. Gray or any other victims of police use of excessive force have had their civil rights violated. That's my perception of how this will unfold. And once they've come up with their findings, then there's a negotiation kind of period with respect to how to go forward. This may be that aspects of the Baltimore Police Department are managed by the, well, we're talking about a consent decree. And a consent decree is a list of items that the Department of Justice wants the Baltimore Police Department to change. And this could be very narrow or it could be very wide. It could be a particular precinct. It could be a particular division. It could be the entire police department, and thus they could install a new commissioner. And that commissioner acts to change the police culture, the training, all that sort of thing. So we've seen that happen in many big cities in the United States, most recent case being the Los Angeles Police Department.
Let me make sure I understand the last point you made. When you said they could install a new new commissioner, this would be a decision by the Justice Department, or they could recommend that local officials do that?
It's a court order, and they must comply. And usually there's a long legal battle between the city and the Department of Justice, but the Department of Justice holds supreme in this kind of case. And what the city tries to do, or the police department tries to do, is they try to narrow the terms of reference as much as possible. Obviously, there's a lot of behind-the-scenes negotiation that goes on behind the Department of Justice with respect to exactly what powers the Department of Justice can have, and what kind of benchmarks they need in order to show there's some sort of improvement in the way, like I said, a particular division is managed and run, and or particular outcome measures, so that the Department of Justice is satisfied that the department has made progress on these claims and these benchmarks.
As I said, we're eager to hear from listeners. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday at WIPR.org. Jonathan in Baltimore has called us. Jonathan, what are your thoughts about this topic?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment that these sort of problems have been going on for years, and they have never been addressed. I was a victim of police brutality in Baltimore, 18 years old, being pulled over, and had a police officer ask me where were the drugs in my car. Had no idea what he was talking about. I was immediately taken out of the car, placed in handcuffs, thrown around, spent the evening in jail just to get out and have my car was completely ripped up and seats torn apart. I went through the process of trying to go to Internal Affairs, and the only thing that they were concerned about was trying to vindicate the officer. Now at 35, I go back and just still angry about that experience. And even though it was null processed, I go back and I look the officer's name up in case files, and he has done this to close to 100-something other people, and he is still on the force. And it's just it is an indication that it's a problem, and no one is doing anything about it.
Let me get Dwight Pettit's comment on that. I appreciate your calling, Jonathan.
Jonathan, what the big distinction that is occurring is the advancement of technology. For years, lawyers like myself and community activists have been crying. People indicated that we were crying wolf, that these things were going on, and nobody really believed that they were as outrageous as they were. Now, with the event of technology and cell phones and so forth, the nation is seeing publicly what we've been talking about, and that is what has brought this matter to fruition. You know, I sit here now in 2015, maybe with 15 to 20 open cases in terms of police brutality in Baltimore City sitting on my desk, of which five of those unlawful, wrongful death cases where people were shot in the back, unarmed, while running and so forth, et cetera, et cetera. So the tragedy, if the Justice Department really gets into this with a fine-tooth comb, they are going to, I believe, be shocked as well as the rest of the nation in terms of what's been taking place in Baltimore City.
It is time for us to take a brief break here on Midday, but defense attorney Dwight Pettit is going to stay with us, and so is Professor Jeffrey Ian Ross. And we hope you'll join us, too. You can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can email us at midday at WIPR.org. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cass from Maryland Morning, filling in for Dan Rodericks. We've been talking with defense attorney Dwight Pettit, who's the author of a book, Under Color of Law, about police brutality, and with criminologist and University of Baltimore professor Jeffrey Ian Ross about Baltimore City Police. One of Professor Ross's books is Making News of Police Violence. And we hope that you'll be part of this conversation, too. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. In the Baltimore Sun article this weekend, it says, quote, criminologists and law enforcement experts say Gray's death shows that police lack adequate training to detect injuries, close quote. And certainly the Sun's numbers show that many of the complaints had to do with hypertension, had to do with blood sugar. I mean, there were chronic diseases that needed attention. Is training, Professor Ross, let me ask you, is training a big factor in this picture?
Well, training is important. All police officers are required to undergo a certain amount of training, a certain number of hours. They're also supposed to be certified in first aid, that sort of thing. It doesn't always mean that they follow their training or the policies and procedures that they learned in the academy or ones that are reinforced through in-service training. So one of the important things to keep in mind is that when an individual complains of some sort of medical problem during time of arrest, one of the first things that the police officer is instructed to do is call EMS and not transport the individual, the suspect. And so I think this is a aspect that needs to be examined. I wanted to follow up on something we talked about before the break, and this is, inability to sanction officers and or make some sort of meaningful impact on the amount of police use of excessive force. What I will say is that in general, in most police departments, unless there's this sort of culture of brutality that's celebrated, in most police departments, police officers do not like deviant police officers or fellow deviant police officers. In particular, also officers who are lawbreakers. When I talk about deviants, I'm talking about corrupt police officers, those who use excessive police force, that sort of thing. They like police officers who are skilled at their job and that sort of thing. That, keeping that in mind also, too, is that we must take into consideration the power of the police union. The FOP is very powerful in Baltimore, as it is in many big city police departments. And in Maryland, we have something called a law enforcement officers' bill of rights, and Maryland is not alone. There's another 14 states that have this bill of rights, and what it does is it prevents police officers or minimizes police officers talking to their superiors for 10 days, and the conditions under which they can be questioned, interrogated, are very very systematic to minimize the possibility that the officer will be stressed during that time. It also gives officers an opportunity, particularly if there's a couple of them, to get their sort of story straight. So this is something that is an important impediment to convicting police officers and or terminating them and or sanctioning them in these sorts of cases.
Let me take one little issue with that, if I may, not to be argumentative, but through my experience, one of the things that I have found that not only are police officers not sanctioned when they have in fact been involved in police brutality or charges of police brutality, not only are they not protected, but we get into depositions and we found that they have been promoted. And I think of all the cases that we've handled in terms of death and police brutality in the last 20 years, in the last 10, I can only think of about three that were prosecuted. So there's no sanction with criminal prosecution. There's no sanction with the, as was just indicated by Jeffrey, they're protected by the police bill of rights in terms of the police commissioner imposing sanctions. There's no really financial imposition against them because they're protected by the cap, and the Fraternal Order of Police will pay any type of civil damages. And so then when you get into depositions, you find that they have been promoted in most of these cases. And now we even find that they're filing for workman's compensation for the stress that they incurred when they have killed somebody illegally. And so the whole system has set up to reward them and not to, in fact, punish them for illegal activity.
Let's hear from one of our callers, Ed in Pasadena. Ed, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Maybe you dealt with this already, but the statistic about how many cases of being turned away from the city jail included hypertension, and I think that is makes the statistic much harder to interpret. And I think the original story said something about diabetes too, but I can't remember.
Yes, yes, and I did raise that. But the as you recall that graphic in the Sun, the third cause for arrestees not being processed at central booking was facial injuries. So it was also a fairly frequent occurrence.
And my argument has always been that the diseases are in the smaller proportion. And that's the point I was making in the article, that the major source of the injury is police-inflicted injury, more so than diseases in terms of hypertension or stroke or that type of thing.
I don't think we can tell from the particular numbers that
no,
the
you can't
Sun
tell
published
from, no.
That
the No, you can't tell
the
from the numbers. That's just the argument that I made to the Sun when they were doing the article, is that I believe that the higher proportion comes from police-inflicted injury rather than disease issues.
Jeff Ross, I wasn't sure whether your point earlier about police departments, the majority of officers wanting to see their fellow officers or wanting to ostracize deviant officers, whether you were saying that that element of sort of peer pressure is missing in the Baltimore Police Department, or whether you weren't commenting on the Baltimore Police Department in particular.
I wasn't commenting on the Baltimore Police Department in general. We're talking about the notion of professionalism, and I think most police officers in this day and age aspire to be professional, and when they have amongst their ranks individuals who are deviant, you know, who are corrupt, who use or unnecessarily fall back on excessive violence, then these individuals
Jeff, I missed the last thing you said. Your phone crinkled.
Sorry. So these kinds of individuals are not thought up highly. And what amongst most police departments, big city police departments, there is a reliance on professionalism to do one's job. The notion that one can effect an arrest without always having to use the most highest level of violence in order to take a suspect into custody. So, I mean, these individuals, we've seen this, these empirical studies done amongst police officers, when they point to officers who they believe are effective and efficient in their jobs, these are the individuals who can get the job done with a minimum amount of force. They're very good. They have very good people skills. They're very knowledgeable. They can read a situation. And they're professional in all manners. There are officers, and I would argue the vast number of officers in the Baltimore Police Department fall under that category. And it's those who are that rely on excessive force are being watched. The question becomes is whether or not the administration can sanction them. Whether or not they want to is one question. Whether or not they're capable is a different one. And we don't know completely on a factual basis whether or not this is going on.
And I agree that most police officers are good police officers. I'm just saying that the ability that Jeffrey just mentioned to sanction them has been missing either through the codification of law or the police officers' Bill of Rights. They're so protected that even the commissioners who have tried to reform the police department have been stymied and unable to do so.
I'm trying to get a sense, Dwight Pettit, of whether your saying that the use of excessive force is part of what Baltimore police are trained to do, and they and some take it too far, or whether it is rogue actions.
It's rogue action. Of course, the policies and procedures are not going to, in fact, encourage, enforce, or sanction excessive force, because excessive force, at some to some extent, is criminal activity. And so, no, it's not sanctioned by policies and procedures. But you have a growing number, in my opinion, of rogue police officers, because there is no sanction and has been no sanction that have been applied, either criminal-wise or administrative-wise or economic-wise.
Let's hear from Mike, who's calling us from Towson. Mike, welcome to Midday.
Mr. Pettit.
Yes, sir.
Because Baltimore City's police force is predominantly black and the majority of those going into intake are black, are we talking about a black-on-black violence? Is that what your law firm is seeing in the cases it takes?
We're seeing a systemic actions on the part of the police department, inherent in the police department mentality that goes across racial lines. I don't think it has anything to do with whether it's a black police officer or a white police officer, although I do think that the race aspect comes into play, because the population in general that is being sanctioned is white, or being penalized or victimized.
Mike,
it's black. I'm sorry.
Mike, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for calling, Mike. Kay in Baltimore has a question. Kay, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Mr. Pettit, I wanted to know if you had read the report that came out of Chicago, where the Chicago Police Department had to pay out millions of dollars to individuals that they beat into confessing to crimes, and people were incarcerated for crimes they did not commit. And if you think that maybe the DOJ report will uncover some of this kind of activity that has gone on in Baltimore City.
Now, to be quite candid with you, Kay, I haven't read that. But I think you're talking about the torture mechanisms that were set up in the Chicago Police Department.
Yes.
No, I have not read it, but I'm looking forward to reading it.
Kay, thanks for calling. Since Kay took us to Chicago, Jeffrey Ross, let me take us a bit further. You have studied police departments in other countries. Can you talk about how excessive force allegations are handled outside the U.S.?
Well, the United States is actually the model jurisdiction that many police departments look towards or for guidance and to establish their policies. In most of the advanced industrialized democracies, particularly Canada, Australia, the UK, they've looked to efforts such as the continuum of force, which was pioneered here in the United States, which prescribes how police officers should respond to suspects that they want to take into custody, whom they want to interview. And the basic continuum of force outlines that an officer should not meet a suspect with more force than is necessary to gain compliance. So, for example, if an officer wants to instruct a individual to leave the premises because he or she is being unruly, there is a certain level of force that is necessary or acceptable in that situation. Doesn't mean that he or she then reverts to some sort of uses his or her sidearm. And so cities in the United States, cities in Canada, Australia, and the UK have looked at court cases like the Garner versus Tennessee court case, the fleeing felon rules, and they've sent officers and administration over here at the United States over the last 20 years, and we've seen a lot of reforms and a lot of changes and in a very positive way in terms of how we train officers and what rules we institute in our police academies, and they seem to be having widespread use. And so if you interview police officers in London, you interview them in Toronto, you interview them in Montreal, and you talk to them about their excessive force policies, you're going to see a lot of similar language to that which is used in the United States.
Thank you for that. Dwight Pettit, do you expect more people to come forward with personal stories about excessive force?
Well, I think so. I think we're just looking at now the tip of the iceberg
Are you hearing from families who want to start cases?
Oh, of course. I mean, people that want to tell the story. A lot of the cases have passed, and people who were brutalized or lost loved ones and what have you, they are looking forward, I would think, to expressing those occurrences to the Department of Justice, and I would hope that the Department of Justice would be looking back, not just at what happened with Freddie Gray, but looking back with Tyrone West, looking back with Abdul Saddam, looking back further in the past few years as to all the people that have been brutalized, shot, killed, beaten, what have you. So I would hope that that is what the essence of the investigation is going to be about, and that is documenting the past and present history of the Baltimore City Police Department.
I should mention that the police department declined to comment to the Baltimore Sun on the story that we've been talking about. So that's we don't have a police voice in this conversation either. Jeffrey Ross, one last question. There seems to be a lack of transparency about disciplinary actions or about complaints against police officers. Is that a sort of endemic part of police culture? Is that perhaps where some solution could be found?
It's a great question. I think officers are entitled to their privacy, and they want protections for the right of self-incrimination. They're entitled to have legal representation. I think also too that we want to approach this each individual complaint and allegation very systematically and gather the evidence that is appropriate to make a determination whether or not an officer is at fault, whether or not the use of force was appropriate or excessive. No police officer likes to provide evidence that may lead to some sort of disciplinary sanction against a fellow officer. This is a very risky kind of position to be in for an officer who is a witness and or a potential accomplice in the excessive force or death of a individual who is being pursued or in custody when during the effectuation of an arrest. So you're not going to get transparency on this issue, immediate transparency, and there's going to be competing witnesses. I think the addition of cell phone video footage is important, although it is not exculpatory. There have been numerous cases in the United States where cell phone footage, CCTV footage have been provided in court, but still officers have managed to escape a conviction for the charges.
But I think the transparency comes in what we're seeing now for the first time in Baltimore City, and that's prosecution or at least going to a grand jury. Here before you, there was no transparency because the police department closed ranks, the commissioner closed ranks, the political establishment for City Hall closed ranks, and we didn't have a state's attorney that would, in fact, prosecute. So there was no transparency. What I'm hoping this new day and age, if we're not going to get a special prosecutor, at least we have a prosecutorial office that is saying to the public, I'm going to follow the facts, and where the facts lead me is where we're going to go. That's brand new, and I think that's quite a brand new statement and state of mind.
And that's where we'll leave the conversation. I'm really grateful to both of you for talking to us. Defense Attorney Dwight Pettit, criminologist and University of Baltimore Professor Jeffrey Ian Ross. Thank you both.
Thank you, Sheila.
When we return, we'll hear from Fern Shen, founder of local news website Baltimore Brew, which published a story this past weekend about Marilyn Mosby's father, a former troubled police officer. We invite our listeners to join the conversation. 410-662-8780 is our midday phone number, and midday@wypr.org is our email. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast from Maryland Morning, sitting in for Dan Rodericks. And here with me in the studio is Fern Shen, one of the founders of Baltimore Brew, the local online website. And I am looking for what I'm supposed to be saying in introducing you, Fern, so I'm just going to wing this because it's such an interesting article that you published over the weekend that goes into Marilyn Mosby's background. She has often talked about coming from a police background, and you have given us some new insight into that. Tell us about your piece.
Well, Sheila, the new information started with a campaign document. It was never used by her campaign as she was
last summer when she was running for state's attorney.
But it was fascinating and kind of arresting. And in that document, which we've been able to verify, came from the campaign. She is quoted describing her father, a police officer in Boston, as quote unquote a crooked cop. And that was, a heavy thing and couldn't be more appropriate in a way if this is to be, turns out to be correct, which it did. We found documentation in the Boston Globe about it. But so here's our state's attorney prosecuting a case in which police officers are accused of wrongdoing, and her father, went through this personally.
You headlined your article, Prosecutor Mosby's Complex, quote, Police Family Background. Mm. State's attorney's life story gives her an apt perspective on law enforcement issues raised by the Freddie Gray case. And I am looking for her father's name.
Yeah, Alan James
Yes. Is
his name.
And so tell me more about what you actually found out about his situation.
We looked at his situation and found a couple stories in the Globe that talked about it. He was arrested in 1989, August 1989, for assault and robbery. And the allegation was that he and another off-duty cop and a third man had taken money and taken a radio from a man who was in a wheelchair, held a gun to the head of somebody, a third person who was there. This was three people in Dorchester who were essentially being held up for money and drugs by, this was the allegation, two off-duty cops, including Alan James.
And he was acquitted of criminal charges.
He was acquitted. So, it's all fascinating and interesting. He was acquitted of criminal charges, but on the day that acquittal came out, he was asked to leave the force by the then police commissioner. And he apparently fought it, because then the next story that turns up is that the following year he was ordered, the Civil Service Commission found that he should be rehired by the police department. So since then, we haven't been able to find out from the Boston Police Department. We've asked them to verify, did he come back or not? We've contacted Mr. James and given him, information about what what we're about to publish, and he's declined to comment so far. Mm-hmm. What you end up with is just kind of a fascinating story of this character at the center of our case, and she's had a family background that is
her
so
mother
rich.
Was also a police officer, correct?
Both parents were police officers, and she's talked about this quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And all the many profiles, people are so fascinated with her and taken with her. All many profiles have discussed this, her family background in policing. Not only her parents, two uncles and a grandfather were all involved in, police officers in Boston. Her grandfather, in fact, was a founder of the first black officers organization for officers in the Boston force.
Yeah, and you write about him also in an experience when he was young that many black men in Baltimore could probably relate to, where he was treated roughly by Boston police officers. Tell us about that.
It was also fascinating. So he told the story of what inspired him to become a police officer. And he was 12 or 13. This is, comes from a story once again in the Globe. 12 or 13, and he was going to the pharmacy to get a prescription for a sick family member. And plainclothes officers threw him up against a wall and said that he resembled a suspect, or that's what they apparently thought, treated him roughly, threw him up against this wall. And he was only sort of saved by the pharmacist coming out saying, hey, I know this kid. He's, leave him alone. But that was a really, as he tells the story, a seminal experience for him, saying he would never want to see another black person treated this way by a police officer, and it inspired him to become a police officer himself and, you know, not to treat the public that way. So once again, another fascinating layer to the story of, you know, Marilyn Mosby's law enforcement family background.
Here on Midday, I'm Sheila Cast. That's Fern Shen, publisher of the online news site Baltimore Brew, telling us about her reporting on State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby's family background in policing. Marilyn Mosby has been, as this Freddie Gray case has unfolded, sort of a polarizing figure. We certainly heard just a few minutes ago from Defense Attorney Dwight Pettit the kind of support she's getting for having brought these charges and the kind of hope that she represents. There certainly also have been critics of the charges, which we have discussed and will discuss at other times. Do you have a sense of whether this personal reporting that you've added to it, how it's affecting how people are viewing her?
I think that's going to take place over time, Sheila. It's people are still digesting, you know, the basics of her story and, you know, the new things that keep getting added. It's kind of hard to keep track of them now. We have the Prince concert where she was on stage, and people are trying to kind of understand where she's coming from in getting involved in, you know, in something like that, if that was appropriate or not. I think people have a lot to process about this. But, you know, looking, I mean, what we have found that her police family background is so complicated is it's almost like something for historians to chew over time. I don't know even if it's going to play into the current debate. She seems to, you know, you can't, it's would be surprising if she didn't bring out her police background, and because she's stepping into something that is so polarizing. We're talking about the question of trust. Can, you know, can the citizens trust police officers, the balance between their law enforcement activities and, you know, their behavior?
If you would like to be part of this conversation, please call us here at Midday. You can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can email us at midday@wypr.org. We'd love to get your thoughts about the state's attorney and how she is handling this situation and what your expectations are of her. How did this come to light, this information?
We obtained this document and were kind of scratching our heads what to do with it. And then along came the Freddie Gray case. And it seemed like something that we couldn't not publicize. It seemed like an important thing for the dialogue, for, you know, history. I mean, this story has captured the country's and the world's attention. And Marilyn Mosby is a person who is, you know, clearly at the center of it. People, you know, as you know, have just been swept away with gratitude, many of them, for the way she's presented the case and, you know, spoke with some emotion and passion, and others have, you know, really criticized her for, you know, undermining her own case and credibility by doing that. So I think knowing the person who is involved and what, you know, personal experience they bring, what passion they bring, what, you know, family history they bring, it seemed to us really important. So we laid it out there for people.
OJ is calling us from Baltimore. OJ, welcome to welcome to Midday.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to make one quick, really two, if I have time, I'll do. The first one is the notion of most police officers being good officers. I question that only because, although I agree most officers probably would not deliberately violate someone's rights, I do think that most officers would not report on a fellow officer whom they observe violating someone's rights, and they observe this blue wall of silence. And
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last point.
They observe the blue wall of silence.
The blue wall of silence.
And any officer that observes the blue wall of silence, as it's sometimes called, I don't see how you can call that officer a good officer, because they're not upholding the law like they've sworn to and like they're being paid to. The other thing you mentioned, just as like a kind of a fallback to before, the 3,000 person, the 2% of people that were too injured to be admitted to correctional facilities, that's probably a small fraction of the actual people that are excessively abused. But those are just the ones that were so bad that they required immediate medical attention. The officers probably don't intentionally use excessive force to require medical attention, but they probably intend to probably stay just below that threshold. Those are just the ones where they kind of maybe went a little further than they intended, but that's probably still a small fraction of the actual number of excessive cases.
Yeah. All I can say just listening to that is just coming from my own experience of reporting this story over the last couple weeks. Every time I would go out for whatever the premise of the story was and just chat with people around, you would hear stories of people's, you know, bad experiences with the police, and they were just everywhere.
Certainly there have, a lot of people have come forward. But then we also, as OJ began his phone call saying, most officers are good, except that he thinks they don't go in far enough in reporting. OJ, I appreciate your calling. Kyle from Baltimore is on the line. Kyle, welcome to Midday.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Call. One observation that I had was just that in listening to what you guys have been talking about and listening to a lot of people talking about through the Baltimore area, a lot of people are very much focused in on her personal story, but not as much focused in on her prosecutorial experience and how she's handled other cases or cases that are similar in the past. And I think it would be interesting to hear more about that aspect of Ms. Mosby and how that experience will lend to how she'll approach this case. And I think that she's really done something that is really important and great for the country in moving this issue of police brutality forward, and that's something that I think has been glossed over as well, is that you've had many other state's attorneys in similar cases that have not been able to bring a case to trial to even have charges where she's brought a bevy of charges that where it could result in possible conviction.
Well, of course, one of the comments, Kyle, when she was running is that she doesn't bring a great deal of prosecutorial experience. She's certainly one of the youngest chief prosecutors in the country. Fern, what would you say to Kyle?
I think the proof will be in the pudding.
Asking about what professional experience she brings to this.
Oh, yeah,
she was in the prosecutor's office. She was not very...
Not very long. People pointed out, you know, during the candidacy, during the race, that she hadn't handled her own homicide case. So, you know, she had a lot of, she didn't have a ton of experience, and people faulted her for that. And yet she, you know, beat a candidate who outspent her 3-1. I think the caller raises a good point about her her background and her, you know, ability to do this. She's, you know, other people have pointed out she has very good people around her in the office. You know, if she can rely on them, she may do fine, despite you know, her lack of experience.
So, Kyle, we have a lot to look forward to. I appreciate your calling, and I appreciate all of you for listening. I want to thank Fern Shen for coming in and sharing her reporting with us from Baltimore Brew, the online news site. Prosecutor Mosby's complex police family background is the headline of the story. Lunch for today's guest was provided by Bagby's Pizza Company, located in historic Bagby Building near Harbor East. Bagby Pizza is open daily from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Deliveries available nightly from 5 to 9 p.m. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. At 1, we'll hear about an event last night where Baltimore grassroots organizers rallied for change, and we'll speak to a law professor about the need for civic infrastructure. Stay with us here on Midday.